You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1991 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fifth class in a series given by Brother George Booker on the subject, The Revelation of Jesus Christ.
I have a confession to make. We're not going to cover everything I would have liked to, but that was probably inevitable given the subject. Some of what I'm going to do today is going to be very much a summary. I'm going to miss out on some of the Bible passages that I would have liked to read and comment on and discuss with you for a bit. But it may seem more so today even than in a couple of the previous days, we're going to be taking certain things for granted. And that's because of the premises I've tried to establish, but admittedly, there's never quite enough time to deal with questions and possibilities here. So I'm saying that up front once again. We left off on page 30 of the notes yesterday, and we were talking about who is the beast, and I was suggesting that there is a connection between Babylon and the beast. We might expect that. Babylon is mentioned a number of times in the Apocalypse, as is the beast, and there are several mutations, if that's a good word, of the beast. He seems to take different forms at different times. And we're talking about various nations. I think we all take that for granted. It's a matter of how we put them together, if need be, and how we sort them out. At the bottom of page 30, we had a quotation from Daniel 4, where Nebuchadnezzar was a man in the Old Testament whom God treated like a beast and made to be like a beast. And another little point there, which I didn't include in the notes, but it occurred to me a bit later, is this. In Daniel chapter 3, we won't bother reading the whole passage, but in Daniel chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar causes that an image would be set up, and men are called upon to worship that image under pain of death if they refuse. And of course, Jews in that situation found themselves taking a stand of conscientious objection against such worship, obviously, and were in danger of losing their lives. So that idea is also found in the book of Revelation in chapter 13 of the beast and the second beast, who seems to be something like his mouthpiece, and they're working in concert with one another, and the second beast causes that an image be set up to that first great beast whose deadly wound was healed and who is recovered. So there's some aspects of comparison between Daniel and Revelation once again, and this idea of an image being set up which is to be worshipped. And it just calls our attention, as we have on the overhead, to the original Babylonian Empire, which was basically this area bounded here. And it is almost exactly the same area that we've been talking about all along in discussing that special land or Eretz that was promised to Abraham from the Nile River to the Euphrates River. And the Babylonian Empire covered just about that area, maybe a bit more on different sides. And so there seems to be very clearly a Babylonian connection with the beast, and that would suggest to us that, as the map on page 31 would show, the Babylonian Empire, the same thing we've been looking at on the overhead, it would suggest to us that the beast of the last days is Babylonian. And that might point us, if we're talking about a geographical identification, and I realize there are other possibilities in different times and when we come from different perspectives, but if we're talking about a geographical sense of this, and talking about this very area in the Middle East, then Babylon would lead us to look at Iraq. And we talked just briefly yesterday about Saddam Hussein. Could he be the beast who draws together various nations in a final great war against Israel? Possibly. I would not want to say definitely, but I would say possibly. And if Saddam Hussein were to be completely removed from the scene, then I might expect that someone else would come along who adopts many of the same philosophies and who has the same ambitions. In fact, it seems as though our brother Chris in the previous class was talking about the bubbles coming up in the pond. It seems as though the Arab world is in ferment and the bubbles keep coming up, and there's the bitterness and the hatred underneath that finally realizes itself in spokesmen who have a political philosophy, chief among the points of which is the hatred of Israel and the destruction of Israel. So we can see the continual ferment in the Middle East. If Saddam Hussein isn't that man who brings about this last great cataclysm, then surely it would be someone very much like him. On page 31, We have a quotation from Revelation 13, the first couple of verses, talking about the beast a bit further. I stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And the beast which I saw was likened to a leopard. His feet were as the feet of a bear. His mouth was the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. Notice the little diagram underneath. This beast combines the characteristics of Daniel's four beasts. And we're probably all familiar with how Daniel 7 really parallels Daniel 2. We have one more pictorial representation of the kingdom of men in its various aspects as, we talked about this before, as particularly it affected Israel. And so the beast of Revelation 13 was like a leopard. This identifies it with the third beast in Daniel chapter 7. It had feet like a bear, which is an identification point of the second beast in Daniel 7. It had the mouth of a lion, which was the first beast, and it had 10 horns, which seems to identify it with the fourth beast. So all four of these beasts wrapped together. It's another sense, I think, of talking about the image standing on its feet in the last days, the idea that all of these different aspects come together in one entity or one confederacy of nations. So there should certainly be some place in our philosophy for Rome and Greece, as well as Babylon and Medo-Persia. The apocalyptic beast appears then to be a composite of all four beasts of Daniel 7. Furthermore, the four beasts have collectively 7 heads and 10 horns. I'm talking about the four beasts in Daniel chapter 7. We can't read it all, but it's there, and it becomes obvious when we scan through the chapter. The lion, the bear, and the fourth beast each had one head, as beasts of prey and animals are supposed to have. But the leopard, the third beast, had 4 heads. And so if we take 1 plus 1 plus 1 and the 4, then the 4 beasts together had 7 heads, which you'll have to admit is a rather unusual alignment, but it's very striking, and it carries us over into the book of Revelation, and we find this beast with 7 heads. Also, if we take the 4 collectively, we're dealing with 10 horns, and all those 10 horns were found on the fourth beast, but they're carried over apparently and grafted into the great beast to be found in Revelation. So once again, indication that we're talking about a conglomeration, a coming together, a composite of all of the 4 previous beasts. I think I'm going to depart from the order that I have in the notes here and just mention something. And this is really because of the time involved. On page 33, just to further stress that idea, under the category of 666, there's a reference to Revelation 13 and verse 18, and then the notes say, the beast man with his allies is a composite of all those who have trampled Jerusalem under their feet. So Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome are not mentioned as the 4 great world empires that rule over the whole globe. They never did. And if they were stressed as being those kind of empires, then there would be other empires that ruled over great tracts of land too. But what sets them apart is these were 4 great empires in turn that trampled down Israel and ruled over and subjugated the people of Israel. And so the point there is made, and this is, take this merely as a collateral idea, not as necessarily the most important idea with the 666, because various ideas have been advanced as we come from different perspectives. But ponder this point. The total years from the first subjugation of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, and we have, according to secular history, an exact date for that, March the 16th, 597 B.C., to the beginning of the final siege of Jerusalem by the Roman Empire after the days of Jesus, when Jesus had ascended to heaven, in early April of A.D. 70 is almost exactly 666 years. The overhead here helps with that just a bit. There were, of course, several points, several times that were prominent in Nebuchadnezzar's dealings with Babylon. The final fall of Jerusalem was about 587, but an initial subjugation of Jerusalem took place in 597. So to some extent, this is selective, but even with that criteria, it does become quite interesting. 597 B.C., the date when Nebuchadnezzar took Jerusalem for the first time, put in place a puppet king who finally rebelled and brought about that last defeat and destruction of Jerusalem. Add to that 70 years on the other side, of our time period, and we come to the final siege of Jerusalem by the Roman legions almost exactly to the day, within maybe a few days, the best I can tell, of the anniversary of that event of 597 B.C. Add those two together, you get 667. You say, oh, that's not 666. It is, because we subtract 1 year. There's no year zero going from B.C. to A.D., and we're dealing with almost exactly 666 years. Now, going back to the top of page 32, remember I pointed this out to you. I said, if you like the nuts and bolts, you want to talk about horns and heads and so forth, this chart you might find interesting. It was my attempt. I did it several years ago, and then I've sort of tinkered around with it. And I'll probably do more tinkering next month and the month after. But here you are, a snapshot in time of someone who is pondering what these heads and horns are. Now, five columns there. The four kingdoms, and I think everybody, you know, that's standard, not just amongst Christadelphians, but it has been standard for many years amongst Bible believers, looking at Daniel chapters 2 and 7. The seven heads of Revelation, I just talked to you about how that came about. Greece there broke up into four heads after the death of Alexander the Great. I'm not going to go into a lot of history. But basically, they would correspond in modern terms to the nations of Greece, Turkey, Egypt, and Syria. They were the four parts, so to speak, of the Grecian Empire in later times. Then moving over to the third column and the fourth column, think of those two as being parallel to one another. This is the suggestion that I've made earlier, that the ten nations of Psalm 83 might be related to the ten kings or the ten horns of Revelation. Sort of the last stage of the Roman Empire after a hiatus or a period of absence, we come back to the last days and we see vestiges of the Roman Empire in the Arab nations that are still there, occupying part of that ancient territory, now preparing to attack Israel. So the ten nations of Psalm 83, that's the best listing of them in one place, may match up with the ten horns of Revelation. And in the final column, that was sort of for completeness sake, we have Gog and Magog of Ezekiel 38. And some of those nations that are listed there, such as Persia, are in fact part of Daniel's four kingdoms, four nations. Others, like Libya and Ethiopia, don't seem to fall into that category. They come separately. It seems to be generally different from the ten horns, though there may be some points of comparison. Now, we'll read through some of the notes at the bottom. Most of the above analysis derives from these basic premises, that the beast of Revelation is a composite of Daniel's four beasts, and as I said, the ten nations of Psalm 83 correspond to the ten horns. Down a bit further, the asterisk there marks five heads which had ruled over Israel by the time of John. And the asterisk points out to us Iraq, in the second column, Iraq, Iran, Greece, Egypt, and Syria. These five heads had ruled over Israel by the time of John. Egypt, which is probably what is meant by the king of the south in Daniel chapter 11, and Syria, which is probably the king of the north in Daniel chapter 11, each ruled for only brief periods during that disruptive period leading up to and beyond the time of the Maccabees, when Israel was sort of independent but not completely, and they were dominated by these parts of the old Grecian Empire leading up to the time of Rome. Now, point number one under the notes, we've talked about that before, the Arab nations as maybe what's left of the old Roman Empire in the Middle East. We needn't mention that again. Note number two, the sixth head, and that note number two points us to Rome, of course, in the second column. The sixth of the seven heads of Revelation, according to John in Revelation 17, verses 9 and 10, now is. In other words, at the time that John was writing, Rome ruled over Israel. So the sixth successive kingdom of these seven heads that Daniel has in mind that was ruling over Israel. The seventh head, that's note number three, and it points to Turkey. The seventh head is yet to come. That is, Turkey or the Ottoman Empire, which ruled over the Middle East for a great deal of time, but possibly only a short time as regards the people of Israel. So I point that out. And then that leaves us with all seven of the heads in turn having ruled over the land and the people of Israel for various periods up to the time of John and beyond the time of John, right into our day, into the 20th century. And now Israel has been delivered from the Ottoman Empire, delivered from Turkish domination, and they have become an independent nation. But Revelation 17, and again I'm paraphrasing and bringing together different passages, we're probably familiar with it to some extent, speaks of an eighth head, one whose wound was healed, who stands up in the last days and dominates Israel for a brief time. And so it might be that that eighth one who is coming, that eighth head, would be equivalent to the beast that's described elsewhere. And since it has a deadly wound that was healed, it could be one of the seven that had come onto the scene, had passed away, and now is coming back again. Those are, of course, suppositions, and that's what we can say about it at this point. But we know the area we're talking about. We know basically the groupings of nations in which these things have happened in the past and from which we might expect similar things to happen in the near future. Under general comments, B, given the above assumptions and observing the world around us, it seems possible that either Iraq or Syria could become the dominant military power among the Arab nations. And I said either Iraq or Syria could become the dominant nation. And of course, Iraq, which corresponds to Asher or Assyria, is one of the ten horns, at least if we follow our hypothesis to this point, and being the equivalent of Babylon, the very first of the four kingdoms, it is one of the seven heads. So where the heads and the horns come together, one of those places would be Iraq or Babylon or Assyria, because Assyro-Babylon was really one empire in different manifestations. Over to point C at the top of page 33. I actually wrote this note to myself about 4 or 5 years ago, which might explain why I got all excited when Iraq invaded Kuwait. I wrote, Iraq might grab the Gulf oil fields, thus uprooting three of the other horns, like Saudi Arabia or Kuwait. Iraq would then become the head of gold, perhaps the economic ruler of the world. Again, very similar to the original Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian head of nations and preeminent commercial power of his day. It didn't quite work out that way, but the interesting thing is it hasn't necessarily been completely ruled out. We have the man Saddam Hussein, who is still clinging to power and perhaps growing in power again, even though the great might of the U.S. was supposed to crush Iraq. It didn't quite achieve that, and that becomes a very interesting point. It leads us to the conjecture that Saddam Hussein could be the beast whose deadly wound did not destroy him, but left him alive. And that wound could be healed, and he could come back to preeminence again. I'm saying lots of coulds and possiblys, and I realize that, and I want you to hear that, but at least suggestions. Point D, Iraq is absolutely anti-Semitic and might be influenced even further against Israel by the likes of Arafat. Could Arafat be the little horn with a mouth speaking great things? What are we told in Daniel about the little horn? The little horn comes up after the other ten horns are in place. I'm sorry we can't read all the passages, but I think everyone would agree with that reading of the passage in Daniel. Now, if we go back to the list, once again, the ten horns of Revelation on page 32, we have Iraq, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, United Arab Emirates. I could have added Bahrain. When I put that map up on the board, up on the chart a couple of days ago that showed the 10 independent nations that have come into existence between the 1920s and the 1960s, included in those 10 was Bahrain. It just occurred to me within the last week or two that though typically I've always, lately, put the Palestinians into this list of the 10 nations or the 10 kings, they are not an independent nation. They would love to be independent. They would love to have a territory of their own, and they're making a lot of noise, and Arafat is sort of a little fellow who's speaking big things continuously, but they haven't yet become independent. But it just strikes me that could this be a possibility, that there are 10 horns in place, or 10 nations that have come into being in the 20th century, the trees that have developed along with Israel, and then in the midst of them there comes up another one, a little one that speaks great things, so it becomes independent and supplants three others, Jordan, Lebanon, whatever, and becomes a spokesman for the Arab cause, speaking great and blasphemous things against the people of Israel. So somehow in my mind I can see a consort between Iraq and Saddam Hussein and the Palestinians and Yasser Arafat, and maybe there'll be other spokesmen for those causes if those people were assassinated or deposed. But the players are in place. We just need, I would suggest, the proper mouthpieces and the proper provocation before these things can culminate. And their point number E is Saddam Hussein's recent defeat in the Gulf War, the deadly wound from which he will seemingly miraculously recover, the one who was able to stand up to the might of the U.S. and if not prevail, at least survive, which is a remarkable thing and would give him great credibility, supposedly, among the Arab nations in the next few years. This little point from the Jerusalem Post a couple of months ago, and of course I think we've seen it progress even beyond this point that we have in April by now, Saddam could regain military power very soon. Saddam is watching the speedy withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region in hopes President Bush would not want to spoil his victory by becoming re-entangled in a drawn-out war with Iraq. If he is successful in these aims, says this Jewish authority on Iraqi affairs, if he is successful in these aims, Saddam will undoubtedly try to rebuild his war machine. In such an event, there is a real danger that we will find ourselves again facing a heavily armed Iraq within the space of several years. The question that occurs to me in looking at world affairs and the politics of the matter is, how many times will the U.S. keep going back into the region to sort out problems? Will there come a time when the U.S. will grow tired of this, when they will feel that their interests don't really lie in continuing to prop up Israel? Maybe they've made deals to find oil elsewhere. They don't feel as though it's necessary to prop up Saudi Arabia and so forth. I don't know. Secret deals are made all the time. The Arabs are very adept at secret deals. Sometimes I get the feeling that George Bush is sort of a naive shopper going through the bazaars of the Middle East, trying to figure out what bargain is being presented to him next. It looks pretty good, but who knows what the aftermath of that will be. That's all I want to say about the beast and so forth for the time being, and I'll leave you with those suggestions and possibilities. If they all prove to be wrong, I'll come back next year and I'll stand here in front of you and I'll admit that I was wrong, and I'm willing to accept that fate. On page 34, I'll just briefly mention this point. I'm not going to try to go through the Bible passages. They're rather lengthy. But the question is often asked, who are the kings who come from the east? One time I thought, well, maybe that's another name for the Arab nations that are going to come, because they are kings who are to the east of Israel. But it's a different expression, the kings from the east, compared to the kings of the earth that we see time after time through the book. And an idea that occurred to me, and I think it's very fitting with the context and also with the passages from Isaiah, is this, that in Zechariah 14, we're told that Jerusalem will be taken and half of the people will be carried into captivity. And as I was suggesting last night, it will be to these people, those who are carried into captivity and those who remain in the land in concentration camps or prison camps, it will be to those people that the Elijah-like prophet or prophets will preach and will turn them back to God. And this will be the preparation, maybe the final preparation for the return of Christ. So that one of the things that Christ will do when he's coming, when he comes, I should say, will be to bring back his people who are captive in various lands back to their own land. Some of these passages in Isaiah, it has been suggested that they're already being fulfilled because God's people are coming back. And yet, if we read them closely, almost every one seems to indicate that God is putting a new heart and a new spirit in these people. They're being called by his name. They are appealing to him to save them. And if we look at the facts of the case, the Jews who are going back to the land from 1917 on are not people who are calling upon the name of God. They're generally speaking agnostic, if not atheistic. So it looks like there is a change of heart in these people, and I'm suggesting that there will be a final defeat of Israel. We've been talking about that for some time, and a final captivity, but that God will bring his people back from those lands, the remnant at least. Maybe the one-third that's referred to in Zechariah will be brought back and they will turn to God. Maybe that's where the 144,000 out of the 12 tribes come from. Those who are in captivity outside the immediate land of Israel, those who are in the land of Israel in captivity, both calling upon God to deliver them. Now, how does that relate to the kings from the east? In the various passages, Isaiah 11, Isaiah 19, Isaiah 27, Isaiah 43, Isaiah 52, almost invariably, these people are spoken of as coming back from captivity in Egypt, once again, or coming back from captivity in Assyria or Babylon, once again. If they have any last days application, I think we all agree that they do, then it sounds like Jews are going to be in captivity, particularly in Egypt and Babylon, once again, and they're going to be brought back from those areas, back to the center of the land. Isaiah 19 talks about Israel will be a blessing in the midst of the land, and blessed will be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands. And we have that map in our mind's eye again, the land or the Eretz that stretches from Babylon, Assyria, or the Euphrates River on one side to Egypt on the other. In the heart of that land is Israel, as though it were divided into thirds. If we see that map, we see Babylon, Assyria on the east. We see Israel in the middle. We see Egypt on the west. And God is saying, I'm going to bring my people back from the corners and the edges of that land. I'm going to bring them back into the heart of the land, to Jerusalem, where they will come to me. So, Revelation 16, verse 12 says, the sixth angel poured out his vial in judgment upon the great river Euphrates, corresponding to Babylon or Assyria, that kingdom to the east, or Iraq, if we want it in modern terms, where people have been carried captive and the waters are dried up, just like the Red Sea was dried up once upon a time, just like the Jordan River was dried up. And I will bring my people back to their own land, that Jewish remnant that is crying to God, and they will come through the dry ground. Isaiah 11 is quite explicit on that. Isaiah 11 mentions the coming back from Egypt and from Assyria. A second exodus from Egypt, a second deliverance from Assyro-Babylon, like those who were carried away in the Babylonian captivity after the days of Nebuchadnezzar. History is destined, I would say, to repeat itself. The same things, very similar things, are going to happen once again. Why are they called kings who come from the east? Because these are they who have come out of great tribulation. These are they who will become a kingdom of priests and will rule with Christ. Jews in those days, as well as Gentiles coming out of other lands. So that, I would suggest, is a possible reading for Revelation 16, verse 12. Turn to page 37. I should mention, before page 37, I'm just going to refer you to these. Pages 40 and 41, the woman of chapter 12 and the woman of chapter 17, along with pages 43 and 44. I can't really talk about this today, but it provides a suggested interpretation of the women of the book of Revelation, which I think in a sense really is one woman who has gone through transmutations. The suggestion is that the woman is symbolic of Israel, and that Israel is that woman clothed with the sun and the moon and the stars in connection with her. There are various Bible passages for that. And then, strangely, in the typology of Revelation, the woman of Israel becomes transformed into two different women. And I think we can appreciate the sense of that. The woman of Israel, I'm not going to try to go into the details, as I said, but the woman of Israel is transformed into two different women. There becomes the bride of Christ. We're thinking, looking at this from a Jewish perspective. Obviously, the bride of Christ includes Gentiles. You can imagine divided into two. And part of that woman becomes the bride of Christ, the 144,000 out of the 12 tribes standing on Mount Zion eventually with the Lamb. And the other part of that woman becomes the terrible harlot who turns and persecutes her own people. It happened in, and has, I should say, the mark of Babylon on her, because she has gone over to the other side. She is serving the Babylonians. That sounds awfully strange, I realize. It's been talked about before. I know it sounds strange. But it happened in the first century. In the first century, the nation of Israel was differentiated by the preaching of the apostles, by the preaching of Jesus and the preaching of the apostles, into two separate women. There was the faithful woman that became the heart of the church, that gave birth to the church. And then there was the unfaithful woman, men like Caiaphas and Herod and many of the Pharisees, who hated what was going on and who used the power of Rome who made an unholy alliance, thinking of Herod and Caiaphas especially, who made an unholy alliance with the Gentile power and used that Gentile power to beat down and suppress their own people. And so the early church was threatened most by Jewish animosity and hatred. And it could well be that something similar would happen in the very last days with the preaching of the Elijah prophet and others. The nation is differentiated into two. Instead of Roman overlords, there are Arab overlords. And they're ruling over and subjugating the people of Israel. And out of that group comes a remnant who believe and constitute a part of the bride. And out of that same group is differentiated on the other side, the harlot who is disgusting and evil, who is committing fornication with the kings of the land, who has thrown in her lot with the enemy and is using the power they can give her to oppress her own people. That's all I want to say about that. There are certainly other possibilities there, but this one, I think, fits into the basic Jewish scenario and explains the existence of this woman in Revelation 17 and 18. I've got to say one more time, I think the woman in Revelation 17 and 18 can refer to other harlots at other times as well. But we're sticking with one particular scenario here for the last days as related to Israel. And so that's my suggestion of how it fits. If you're puzzled by that, one thing I would suggest is to read pages 40 through 45, notice some of the comparisons, and judge for yourself. Now, going back to page 37, there are two things I'd like to do in the last minutes. One is to read briefly through a suggested outline of the sequence of events in the last days, pages 37 and 38, which basically doesn't rely on the book of Revelation. And then I'd like to read through the scenes from the Revelation on pages 45 and 46 to fix in our minds some of these main events and how they fit together. So once again, we're not going to read the Bible passages, we're going to read the main headings. A suggested outline of the sequence of events in the last days, page 37. A final Arab-Israeli war resulting in a devastating defeat for Israel. The same basic order of events in many prophecies applies. Arabs invade and annex Israel, point A, especially fighting about the ancient high places, the heavenly places. Remember, we've talked about that both from other passages and from the book of Revelation. Divine judgments come upon them. A manifestation of divine glory destroys them. And that is true in many of the Bible passages, which would suggest, I would say, would prove that 1948 and 1967 aren't the fulfillment of the defeat of the Arab nations. Even though Israel was able to put them off and establish their territory, they're only going to be finally destroyed by divine glory shining forth upon them that will save Israel and deliver Israel from her enemies. Now, that sort of sets the stage and provides the overview or the umbrella for what could happen in and around Israel in the last days. Under that umbrella, then, these are the things that are happening with Israel. Point number two, Israel's defeat will bring about national repentance, a necessary preliminary to the return of Christ. This is probably accomplished through the preaching of Elijah, there's Revelation 11 that we talked about last night, or a prophet and teacher like Elijah, which I think is more likely. Now, I thought you might be disappointed if we didn't have one more of these, so I found one. I'll read it to you because the writing is a bit small. Charlie Brown is watching TV and there's a golf tournament on. And the voice of the announcer from the TV says, "All right, golf fans, this is it. The old pro has to make this one. He's down to the last putt and he can't play it safe. He has to go for it. There's no tomorrow." And just as he says there's no tomorrow, Sally walks by, and that's all she hears as she walks by the TV. And she says, "There's no tomorrow. There's no tomorrow." And she goes running out to tell everyone, "There's no tomorrow. They just announced it on TV." I think anything that's going to happen in the world from now on, we're going to find out about it on TV. They just announced on TV that there's no tomorrow, and she wakes Snoopy out of an afternoon nap. "There's no tomorrow. They just announced it on TV. Panic, panic, run, hide, flee, run for the hills, flee to the valleys, run to the rooftops." And in the final scene, everybody is sitting on top of Snoopy's roof, and Linus says, "Somehow I never thought it would end this way." And Snoopy says, "I thought Elijah had to come first." And Malachi 4 talks about the coming of Elijah before the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Oh, about Elijah, a bit more seriously. There's the full text of a couple of Bible passages. I will send my messenger to prepare the way before me. The Lord will come suddenly to his temple. There are probably enough passages like that, he will come suddenly to his temple, that have left me pondering lately if in fact what we're going to see is the rebuilding of a Jewish temple. So we're not talking about temple merely in a spiritual sense of he will come to his believers, but there may be some literal temple. And if you can imagine something that would provoke the Arabs more than anything else, it could be building a Jewish temple on the Temple Mount, either with or without destroying the Dome of the Rock. It would be tremendous provocation. Cooler heads would probably keep it from happening, but in Jewish and Arab affairs, cooler heads don't always prevail. I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of the fathers back to their children, and the hearts of the children, he will turn the hearts of the fathers back to their children, to be like children, I would suggest, and the hearts of the children back to their fathers, that is, to remember, I would suggest, the covenants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to remember the gospel that was preached in earlier times. And that, of course, will remove the curse from the land of Israel. And then I should have had this overhead last night. It would have been quite useful. 3.5 literal years, possibly. Luke 4 and verse 25, that was the passage I couldn't think of last night. Elijah prayed earnestly and heaven was shut up for 3.5 years. James 5, he prayed fervently that it might not rain, and for 3 years and 6 months it did not rain on the earth. And then Revelation 11, I will grant my two witnesses power to prophesy for 1,260 days, 3.5 times 360 days per year, or 3.5 years. They will have power to shut the sky that no rain may fall during the days of their prophesying. So in those earlier passages, and 1 Kings chapter 17, I think it is, the 3.5 years were literal, and that suggests to us the possibility that we're dealing with a brief, literal period of time of 3.5 years at the very end, involving this common factor of Elijah and the fact that there will be no rain for a time, and this will be a period of testing and trial, but out of that will come a remnant of Israel who believe. So, the preaching of Elijah the prophet, number 2, back to the outline. Number 3, in response to Israel's repentance and prayers, presumably at the end of this 3.5 year period, or slightly longer, if we take the 1290 and the 1335 of Daniel 12, Christ comes back to Jerusalem. Remember the passages in Ezekiel that we looked at a couple of days ago. The glory of God leaving the temple or the heavenly place because of the wickedness of the nation, and the glory of God coming back into the temple or the heavenly place with the return of Christ. And how Ezekiel 43 matched up with Zechariah 14 verse 4. His feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is to the east of Jerusalem. And he will come into the city. In Acts chapter 1, Jesus standing on the Mount of Olives, ascending into heaven, this same Jesus that was taken up from you will so come back. The Mount of Olives is where the glory of God departed into heaven, as Ezekiel saw, and it's where the glory of God returns and comes back into his holy place. The responsible dead are raised, point number 4. Notice how neatly I handled that. The responsible dead are raised, and along with the living are called away to judgment. Again, I would suggest at Jerusalem. What makes that fascinating is the Temple Mount at Jerusalem, the Holy Mountain, was originally a threshing floor. The threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite for the separation of the wheat from the chaff. And Jesus says the chaff is burned with unquenchable fire in Gehenna. And Gehenna is the valley of the son of Hinnom, which is just down in the valley from the Temple Mount, the elevated place. And to imagine a great judgment taking place there or very near there is quite fitting from a number of Bible perspectives. Those who are gathered into the 144,000 and the great company which no man can number with Christ on Mount Zion, and the chaff burned up with unquenchable fire in Gehenna, just there to the side. And it explains, I think, many of the figures in the book of Revelation of the heavenly places. The temple is opened up, and there we see the 144,000 praising God, and then the temple doors are closed, so to speak. That's Revelation 15. And no one can enter into that area while the last great judgments are being poured out upon the land. And then the temple is opened once again. and from heaven, or from that heavenly place, the New Jerusalem, the embodiment of the glorified saints, comes down into the earth, into the land, and filters out and brings peace and righteousness to the world. That was point number 5 on page 38. Points number 6 and 7, don't think of these so much as happening afterward. I think probably they happen concurrently. The oppressed Jews in and around Jerusalem are delivered by the King of Glory who comes to save them. The Jews who have been carried away into captivity, those passages we just mentioned back several pages before in the notes, are delivered back to Jerusalem in a second exodus out of Egypt and Babylon and Assyria and other lands at the very edges of the Eretz that we've been talking about. And so if these are Jews who truly believe, then obviously they're going to be a part of the judgment and the glorification of the saints along with the Gentiles, and the two companies will ultimately come together. So that could be happening concurrently with 4 and 5. Numbers 8, 9, 10, and 11 become more general points that kind of bring the story to a close. Nuclear war with a question mark, with disastrous short-term results for much of the world. Christ's worldwide kingdom is proclaimed and established in Jerusalem. The Gog-Magog invasion, the last great attack against the saints and against Christ, which is mentioned toward the end of Revelation and mentioned in Ezekiel 38 and 39, is also taking place or developing at this time, or maybe after Christ is enthroned in his kingdom, or maybe even some time afterward, and I'll leave that as very much an open question. And then the millennium, which is the 1,000-year reign of Jesus Christ and his saints on the earth. Page 39 is just a summary of all the passages where the 1,260 days, the 42 months, the 3.5 years occur, and if you line them all up, you can see that maybe they're all concurrent with one another, and they're describing things that from other Bible passages we can see will happen in the very last days. So evidence for the possible interpretation, the literal interpretation of the 3.5 years at the end. The last few minutes, we just read through the scenes from the Revelation, pages 45 and 46. And just get the ideas in your mind, the general things that are happening here. Starting with chapter 6, the seven seals are opened. There are war and death and famine and plagues and a great earthquake as figs dropping from a fig tree, perhaps showing that these plagues are coming upon Israel. The result of the seals is there is a sealing process by which the nation of Israel is differentiated into two, and a remnant who believe through the preaching of Elijah or whatever come to Christ and come to God, and they are the ones who are ultimately saved along with Gentiles coming, as it says, the great multitude out of all nations. Now, more or less at the same time, it would seem to me, chapters 8 and 9 are picturing terrible judgments coming upon the land of Israel. Notice the fifth trumpet, smoke out of the abyss, the Sinai desert, a great army of locusts, the same as the word for Arab, come out of the bottomless pit, and they approach the land of Israel. That would be very comparable with the prophecy of Joel. So judgments are coming upon the people of Israel while that remnant is being differentiated and developed out of the nation. Great judgments and trials and the suppression and subjugation of the people of Israel. And imagine how that would be. Imagine how Arabs, if given a free hand, would treat the people of Israel. They wouldn't be able to kill everyone immediately, but certainly they would do something quite comparable to what Hitler's Third Reich did, and they would be in the process of getting rid of the Jewish problem once and for all. But out of that, out of this terrible suffering, there come those who turn back to God. Now, what's interesting about the trumpets is they fall upon one-third of the land. Think of that land that we've been looking at in all the maps from Assyro-Babylon through the land of Israel into the land of Egypt. And to my mind, it wouldn't be too difficult to see Israel as being one-third of that land. And so judgments upon Israel in the first place. But then, notice what happens. We move, and let me skip forward for just a second, the next page, chapters 15 and 16, and the final seven plagues, which are the bowls, or the vials, they are poured out on all the land. And that's where Babylon and the Euphrates get their comeuppance. It's a good Texas word. So we have judgments on a third, then judgments upon the whole. Now, in between the two, going back to page 45, You wouldn't think we could get through the next 10 chapters of Revelation in 2 minutes, but we're going to do that. Chapter 11, the witnesses, prophesying and preaching and developing the remnant. We see how that can fit into the picture. It goes on for 3.5 years. Then they are killed. Then they're raised from the dead. Then they're called up to heaven. But they don't go to heaven. We all know that. We see them on the Temple Mount with Christ in chapter 14. A woman clothed with the sun. We talked about chapter 12. If that wasn't satisfactory, you can do some more reading or agree to disagree on your own. Chapter 13, the beast. It's as though chapters 11 and 12 and 13 are talking about the same general period. And that's where the 42 months, 1260 days, 3.5 years, same general period indicate we're in the same frame, but we're looking at it from different perspectives. Chapter 11 is the Jewish remnant being developed in the midst of persecutions. Chapter 12 is this woman of Israel. We're kind of seeing how Israel plays this out and eventually divides up into two and becomes a harlot in part because they haven't been redeemed and they haven't been touched by the preaching and they make alliances with the enemy. And that anticipates chapters 17 and 18 and how that portion of the nation is destroyed along with the enemies of God's people. And then chapter 13 is focusing on that great beast, the seven heads and ten horns, as though this is the embodiment, the focusing of all the enemies of God's people from all times past, now coming together in the very last days. And we can put together whatever alignments we want, but we basically know the nations of the world, especially the Arab nations, hate Israel. Given the right provocation, they'll destroy her again. The Lamb on Mount Zion, chapter 14, angels announce the impending fall of Babylon. Thrust in thy sickle, for the harvest is ripe. The seven last plagues come upon the whole land, including Egypt and Babylon, and the oppressors of Israel are being destroyed. Chapter 17, I would suggest, is this Jewish woman, the harlot, who has made her pact with Babylon, has become like Babylon, has the mark of Babylon on her. She is destroyed too, just as Herod and Caiaphas perished along with the other enemies of the church in the first century. And chapters 19, 20, 21, and 22 present the final battles, the cleanup process, so to speak, what is called Armageddon, that may involve other nations, may involve the Catholic Church, may involve every opposition against Christ. And then we come to the new heavens and the new earth in chapters 21 and 22. And to sort of provide a different conclusion to the discussion of beasts and heads and horns, we read Revelation 21, verses 1 to 7. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling of God is with men. He will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death shall be no more, neither shall there be any mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. And he who sat upon the throne said, Behold, I make all things new. Also he said, Write this, for these words are trustworthy and true. And he said to me, It is done. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the fountain of the water of life without payment. He who conquers shall have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. Then he showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, through the middle of the street of the city. Also on either side of the river, the tree of life with its 12 manner of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. There shall no more be anything here which is accursed, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall worship him. They shall see his face, and his name shall be upon their foreheads. Behold, I am coming soon. Blessed is he who keeps the words of the prophecy of this book. He who testifies to these things says, Surely I am coming soon. Amen. Come, Lord Jesus. Thank you very much for your kindness to my family and me this week. And I've enjoyed being here. We've enjoyed being here very much. And we hope that we see you again.